Welcome, friends. I am Patrick Dransfield, and I will be your guide through this seminar. We are very grateful for the support of Emmanuel Givanakis, CEO of Financial Services Regulatory Authority of the ABGM. In a sign of how busy at least one of our three cities is, Emmanuel is currently taking a senior delegation from the original great city, London, around Abu Dhabi Global Market's magnificent facilities. He promises to join us before the end of this Zoom webinar, however. Borrowing from Charles Dickens' original bestseller, A Tale of Two Cities, we wanted to highlight to you all the importance of both Dubai and Abu Dhabi, the latter being UAE's capital city. This takes some explanation for those of you who, like me, are from England, where London is by far the major city, or Japan, where Tokyo is a dominant magnet, or China even, where Beijing is the first among equals. In truth, the UAE is a city-state of is a country of seven cities, where not one but two cities are the large jewels in the UAE crown. To quote from Dickens' hero, the London lawyer Sidney Carton, "I see a beautiful city and a brilliant people." That description covers all three cities, Dubai, of course, and not least Hong Kong, my erstwhile home for 27 years, and also my new home, Abu Dhabi. I will leave you to decide which is your preferred beautiful city, but I am delighted to introduce our legal experts to all three cities, starting with the man who has a foot in all seven Emirate cities, Mr. Mohammed Al-Sawaidi, founder of the law firm Al-Sawaidi & Company. Formerly head of legal at Emirates General Petroleum Corporation, Mohammed founded Al-Sawaidi & Company 25 years ago. Mohammed is also a dispute resolution lawyer specializing in arbitration and including matters relating to banking and Islamic finance and intellectual property. He has been appointed as an arbitrator on more than 80 arbitrations to date. So, Mohammed, please give us your welcoming remarks.
Thank you very much, Patrick, and I'm so delighted with so many attendees from all over the world, almost. And I did not expect that many would be attending, but I'm really so delighted. You know, the UAE is a unique country. First of all, it's a federation of seven emirates, the only federation that lasted in the Arab world now for more than 51 years. And this uniqueness, not only it comes because of this federation, but because also we have almost four legal systems that are in the UAE. You know, we have the civil law system that cover all the country, and we have within that civil law system we have also Islamic law system that covers the Sharia related and family matters and family cases, and also we have not only one but two common law jurisdiction in the UAE. One is in Dubai, which is Dubai International Financial Center, and one in Abu Dhabi, which is the ADGM, Abu Dhabi Capital Market. You know, this two offshore system that we have, this is for people to come and, you know, companies that they could use the system that's very familiar with, which is the common law system. And I could be proud to say that my uncle-in-law is the one who founded the IFC, Mr. Anis Al-Jahlaf. So in fact, I had this discussion even before this issue started with him. You know, and the UAE is actually, I would say, the gateway to the whole Arab world and whole of Africa. So a lot of companies just set up in Dubai or Abu Dhabi and operate in the whole Gulf region or Pakistan or India, South Africa, and all the Middle East. Why? Because in the UAE, not only the legal system that could help you, but also the infrastructure that's available. You know, you can fly literally from Dubai or Abu Dhabi almost to most of the major cities. You know, you can fly to San Francisco, and you can fly to Auckland direct, of course, to Beijing and Seattle and London. That's very normal. But we're talking how extreme that it goes. In fact, it takes you all to the South America, to Sao Paulo. You can't fly direct. This is this part of just of the facility that the UAE offer. And the UAE, just last year, I would say, was really the major partner in the Middle East for China. It's the investment was around $20.7 billion, you know, and that's just the beginning after COVID. I see so many Chinese companies are really, signing in. Many Chinese people are coming in and setting up companies in Dubai or in Abu Dhabi to operate through the Middle East, through Dubai and Dubai, Abu Dhabi. Please, Patrick, if I pass my 5 minutes, please step in and let me know. Okay. So the UAE is really, I would say, the gateway to the Middle East. If you want to invest and come in this region, the UAE is your place. And it is the laws are very familiar. We have very strict legal system, and we have very quick legal system. You know, you can have a case, you know, from first instance and to court of appeal in less than six months, you know. So, you can get your rights very quickly if you have any claim in the UAE. So, we are here to help you, you know, as a law firm. And you know, just please, if you have any question, please send it by email or through the chat box. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mohammed. So we're thrilled to have one of the best and brightest boutique law firms in Hong Kong join us as our co-host. Founded by Julia Charlton, the eponymous Charltons, fluent in Putonghua, Julia is a Hong Kong and English solicitor and has practiced in Hong Kong SAR since 1987. Julia is a corporate finance lawyer and inter alia advises regulators on financial institutions and listed companies on the listing rules of both the main board of the Stock Exchange of Hong Kong Limited and GEM. Julia.
Thank you very much, Patrick. So I'm so honored to be part of this webinar featuring Mr. Mohammed Al-Sawedi and his talented colleagues, and also Mr. Emmanuel Gavanakis, CEO of the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of ADGM, is also going to be joining us. I'd also like to mention and underline what Mohammed was saying about the Dubai being a flight hub. It even flies to Newcastle in the UK, where I come from, and there's not that many places where you can fly direct to Newcastle. So back to the main topics for today, which are the legal frameworks of Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and Hong Kong, and doing business in these three vibrant cities. Over the past year, I've also had the pleasure of visiting Dubai and Abu Dhabi on a number of occasions. And whilst I was there, I was hugely impressed by the dynamism and the growth in the UAE. You certainly get the strong impression that Dubai and Abu Dhabi are places who know where they are going and that great opportunities exist there. Even before the Hong Kong chief executive's visit to Dubai earlier this year, Hong Kong already had strong ties to the UAE as its largest trading partner in the Middle East. Indeed, Hong Kong was among the top 10 trading partners of the UAE in 2021. Both jurisdictions have also signed multiple agreements, including the Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement 2019, which committed the jurisdictions to fair and equitable treatment of investors, including the right to free transfers abroad of investments and returns and compensation in the event of expropriation of investments. The two jurisdictions have also signed a number of MOUs, including an MOU between the Hong Kong Science Park and the Sharjah Research Technology and Innovation Park, Hong Kong Cyberport and the Dubai Future Foundation, and between the Hong Kong Trade Development Council and the Dubai Chamber, with the aim to strengthen bilateral trade and business collaboration between the two organizations to support trade promotion initiatives. So these bilateral ties between the UAE and Hong Kong are not just limited to trade and science and technology. Hong Kong also has an active double tax treaty with the UAE. And Hong Kong itself, of course, continues to play a role internationally. Its ranking in the Global Financial Centers Index 32 report is the fourth place globally, and Hong Kong's status as an international financial center and its ability to formulate its own monetary policy and financial policies and to regulate and supervise financial business and markets are also very important. From the perspective of doing business, the Hong Kong dollar has a mechanism which, broadly speaking, means that the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the US dollar at a rate of 7.8 Hong Kong dollars to one US dollar. Hong Kong has a relatively simple tax system, a low rate tax rate with no capital gains or VAT, free flow of information and a free port status. Hong Kong also has 29 of the 30 global systemic banks, positioning Hong Kong as an attractive location for business. And as of last year, there were just under 9,000 companies with their parent companies located outside Hong Kong that had a presence in Hong Kong. And among them, around 1,400 companies had their regional headquarters in Hong Kong, with nearly 250 of them in the finance and banking sectors, and over 160 in the professional business and education sectors. Underlining Hong Kong's role as a bridge to mainland China and as an international financial center, the majority of those parent companies were located in China, including 251 regional HQs, and the remainder were either US, UK, German, or Japanese companies for the most part. On the regulatory front, Hong Kong regulators have continued to update and introduce new legislation, rules, and regulations, particularly in the area of virtual assets. Hong Kong's new regime for the regulation of virtual asset exchanges comes into effect today, actually. So I hope that you will find today's overview of these three dynamic cities and the links between them inspiring. Back to you, Patrick, to introduce the Dubai presentations.
Thank you very much, Julia. And so to the first of the three cities we'll feature today, Dubai. And if we can have the slides up, please. Where the Al-Sawidi corporate team reside. First, we will hear from Senior Associate Vida Serrano and then partner Sunia Kumar. They will tell you in broad strokes about business setup in the UAE. Following them is Rajiv Suri, who is an expert in UAE intellectual property. Following Rajiv is partner and head of dispute resolution, Ali Al-Raisi. Ali is registered to appear in all local and federal courts throughout the UAE. So over to my colleagues in Dubai. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. UAE sustains its position as the Middle East's best place to do business. UAE has continued its strong growth over the recent years and has established itself firmly as a global business hub, attracting regional and international businesses and investors. It has cemented its leading position across various indicators, including ease of doing business. These key trends in the UAE business and legal landscape suggest continued growth of commercial opportunities for investors and corporates looking to capitalize on their presence in the UAE. Federal Decree Law No. 32 of 2021 on commercial companies that came into force last year notably strengthens the principles of foreign ownership of companies, allowing foreign investors to succeed in opening businesses in the UAE and obtain full control of and ownership of their company. Both the Abu Dhabi Department of Economic Development and Department of Economy and Tourism in Dubai identified more than 1,000 commercial and industrial activities for which foreign nationals have the right to fully own an economic license. As the UAE positions itself at the forefront of innovation globally, it is worth highlighting specific initiatives made by the government to promote the transition of the UAE economy into one that is more digitally enabled and ready to adapt to the future. Addressing the impact of COVID-19, the UAE implemented its very first national digital identity, the UAE Pass. The UAE Pass has both the facial ID and digital vault features that are powered by blockchain technology, allowing users to digitally sign and store official documents and to access not only government processes, but also services provided by the semi-government and private sectors. UAE is also the regional leader when it comes to building infrastructure. In contrast to many countries in the world, UAE does not levy any personal income tax. However, starting today, 1st June 2023, the UAE is introducing a competitive corporate tax rate of 9% levied on onshore companies only, having taxable profits above 375,000 dirhams. Next slide. Investors committed to operate in the UAE must decide on the most effective legal form for their businesses. There are three available company formations, and these are the onshore entity, the free zone entity, and the offshore entity. Let me now pass you to our partner, Sunir Kumar, to provide you more information on these types of company formations.
Thank you, Vida. Good morning and welcome to all. As Vida mentioned, there are three jurisdictions in UAE for incorporation of companies. That is onshore, a free zone, and offshore entity. Why nowadays onshore entity is more popular and important for foreign investors? The reason is that foreign investors or expatriate can now own 100% ownership in mainland companies without the need of a local partner. Prior to passing of this new commercial company law, that is law number 32 of 2021, the minimum 51% share capital of the company should be held by the local partner, either a natural person or a juridical person. Even though the local partners are silent partners without an investment in the company, but still they are officially a registered shareholders of the company. And in sometimes, in certain circumstances, it may lead to the dispute. Now, the new commercial company law do away with this, the requirement of the local partner participation in the mainland companies and allowing foreigners to own 100% in the mainland companies, except in certain categories which are security and strategically important. So what are the benefits if a foreign investor or an expatriate incorporate a company in the mainland? The main benefits are they can conduct business activity all over the UAE without any restrictions. They can import, export, and trade within UAE. And there is no visa quota restriction for them. They can participate in the government tenders. So they have a flexibility for selecting and warehousing locations. So they have a wider business activity and wider scope. So because the onshore entity can open bank account very faster compared to other jurisdictions. There are the commercial activities of the mainland are divided into four categories: industrial, that is for manufacturing; commercial, professional, and tourism. The most notable and probable legal system of the onshore entities limited liability company. It can be either a single limited company or it can be a multiple shareholders. So how long it will take to incorporate a company? It will take 1 to 2 weeks to incorporate the company. So also I would like to mention, as Vida also explained, that from today onwards, 9% of the corporate tax is applicable for the onshore entities for the profit margin exceed AED 375,000. Now I'll just move on to the next slide, to the free zone entities. The free zone entities are a specified autonomous jurisdiction within the Emirates, and there are economic areas where goods and services are traded. There are more than 40 multidisciplinary free zones in the UAE. The importance of the free zone is that the most of the free zones are created for the conducting specialized business activities such as multi-commodity trading, gold and diamond, financial activities, IT, biotechnology, scientific and research, healthcare and education, media and publication, automotive trading, logistics and outsourcing, trading and import, etc. So most of the free zones are either nearby the airport or seaport. So what are the benefits of have an opening and a company in the free zone is that they can have 100% full ownership in the business and can have 100% repatriation of the capital and profit. There is no import and export duty. There is an import and export duty exemption, no corporate tax and no income tax. It's a travel-free immigration procedure and virtual office availability. They have an speedy incorporation and the ease of doing business in the free zone. There are several benefits and packages are offering at different free zone authorities. The entrepreneurs who want to tax optimization, they opt for the free zone formation. But main difference between the free zone and the mainland onshore entity is that the main difference that the free zone entity cannot conduct its business operation directly outside the free zone without an agent, where the onshore entities can trade within the UAE without any restrictions. So also, I would like to state that there are two financial free zones in the UAE, namely ADGM and DIFC, which are an independent jurisdiction exempted from the UAE civil and commercial laws, as both financial free zones are a recognized English common law system, and they have their own independent financial regulator. Next, I will move to the onshore entity. These are the onshore entities, the most unfavorable jurisdiction for the foreign investors. The offshore entity, which are mainly known as international business companies, which are limited liabilities, this offshore entity can conduct all permitted business activities outside the UAE without the need of any office or employees in UAE. They can work remotely and shift and expand their business operation to different countries to enjoy the different benefits that country offers. There are many advantages for opening an offshore entity. It is very cost effective and the low renewal cost, minimum documentation, there is a privacy and confidentiality of its shareholders. There can take an advantages of the tax regime. There is no VAT, no corporate tax, no capital gain, no income tax applicable. They have a business flexibility. It's a greater flexibility in terms of international business operation, which allow the company to establish presence in multiple jurisdictions and conduct cross-border transaction. This flexibility can do the business operation, optimize tax planning, and enhance international market access. It can open a bank account either in UAE or outside UAE. They can have an asset protection. It can hold IT, and it can hold the shares in any company. There is no office or employees required. If you have a protection against a lawsuit, there is a regulatory ease. There is no government or administrative restriction, ease of operation, no minimum capital, no deposit is required. It can own any property in UAE and outside, in freehold property here and outside the UAE. So these are the main advantages of opening an offshore company. However, the offshore company cannot conduct business directly in UAE and cannot issue any visas under this company. Why the UAE offshore company is most favorable? Because there is a prestige and reputation, because Dubai has gained a reputation as a global business hub and a center for international trade and investment. Operating an offshore company in Dubai can enhance the company's credibility and reputation, signaling his commitment to international business and creating opportunity for networking and collaboration with other global players. Now I'll move on to the residence visa. So other than the normal residence visa or employment visa, there is a golden visa system in UAE. This UAE golden visa system generates buzz for foreign investors and expatriates who have a plans for securing a long-term residency status in the UAE. This is self-sponsored visa, no sponsor, no employer is required. The golden residence visas range from 5 to 10 years duration. It is a renewable residence visa. This is to attract skilled and talented workers and entrepreneurs to promote growth in the business sector in UAE. The golden visa holders are allowed to stay outside the UAE for as long as they like without affecting their visa status. They can sponsor their family members. In the event of the death of the visa holder, the family members would be able to remain to stay in the UAE. So who are entitled for the golden visa? The professionals, exceptional talent, real estate investors, entrepreneurs, students, graduate and scientists, and the doctors and other eligible for this scheme. Many others are eligible for these schemes. There is also another visa type, is a green visa. There is a UAE green visa. It is a type of residence visa, allow the holders to sponsor themselves for 5 years, eliminating the need of UAE national or employer. The freelancers and self-employed person can apply for the green visa. The bachelor's degree or diploma is required. So there is also another type of visa called investor visa. This investor visa can be obtained, can be given to the shareholder of the company or the partners or shareholder. They can have an investor visa. So there is a normal visa, there is 2 years residence visa. So now I will say what we can offer to the our clients. We can support the clients to help them to set up their business relatively easier. We can provide them tailor-made solutions. We can guide them to select a suitable jurisdiction, depend on their requirements, provide them a full entity management, which includes forced incorporations, restructuring, amendment, visa-related activities, legal consultancy, and then regulatory compliances, and to, in order to expand their business opportunities in the Middle East or in the MENA region. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I now ask Rajiv to join us with an update and comment on IP. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick. I welcome all the attendees to this webinar. My topic for today is intellectual property protection in UAE. Just to inform you, UAE is a member of World Trade Organization. It is signatory to the Nice Agreement, Paris Convention, TRIPS Agreement, Madrid Protocol, Berne Copyright Convention. All this shows great commitment of UAE in providing effective mechanism for IP protection. Now, when we talk about IP protection, there are four types of enforcement actions which are available for protection of intellectual property. It is civil action, criminal action, action through customs, administrative action. Now, when I talk about enforcement actions, I have categorized four major intellectual property rights: trademarks, copyrights, industrial designs, and patents. For trademarks, the validity in UAE is for 10 years, which is followed as per Federal Decree Law Number 36 of 2021. All the four actions are available for trademarks, enforcement, and for copyrights, the validity is for lifetime of author and 50 years thereafter. The Federal Decree Law Number 38 of the 2021 is the statute. It also has all the four actions. For industrial designs, validity for 20 years. Federal Decree Law Number 11, 2021 is the statute. For this, only civil action is provided. There are no administrative, criminal, or customs. For patents, validity for 20 years, and the Federal Decree Law Number 11 of 2021 is the main statute. For this, civil and customs actions are available. Insofar as customs is concerned, there is an intervention required of the court just to seek directions for the relevant directions for the customs authorities. Now, when I talk about civil action, the trademarks law, I'm taking first specific examples of trademarks law, which provides for Federal Decree Law Number 36 of 2021. Under this law, Article 47 specifically provides for obtaining an order on a petition for urgent matters just for precautionary measures, which necessarily lays down the details of infringement, which involves material, goods, etc., involved, which are used for infringement purposes. It seeks for attachment of proceeds resulting directly from infringement. It seeks for probation of goods in commercial channels and preventing their exports, and also helps in maintaining of all the evidence relating to the infringement. Article 48 provides that immediately once the order is passed, one can file a suit for claim of damages within 20 days, although these damages should be a direct result of infringement. Article 49 provides for penalties and fines for forging a registered trademark. It provides for imprisonments not exceeding 1 year and a fine of 100,000 dirhams and up to 1 million dirhams, whereas Article 50 or either of two, whereas Article 50 provides for penalty penalty for deliberately selling forged products and provides for imprisonment not exceeding 1 year and a fine of up to from a minimum of 50,000 dirhams and up to 200,000 dirhams or either of two. Now, when I talk about the criminal action, Federal Decree Law Number 19 of 2016 specifically provides for definitions of counterfeit commodities and commercial frauds. Now, counterfeit commodities are those which bear legally registered trademark without authorization of the IP right holder, and anyone who deals in these sort of counterfeit commodities is defined as committing a commercial fraud. Once these are ascertained, one can go in for complaint with the police or the public prosecutor, which is followed by inquiry, and it also leads to confiscation and seizure of the offending goods. Now, the punishment awarded is imprisonment not exceeding 2 years and a fine of 50,000 dirhams and not exceeding 200,000 dirhams or either of two. However, Article 14 says that if such counterfeiting is being done in respect of human food, animal food, or medical drugs, or organic or agricultural products, imprisonment not exceeding 2 years, fine not less than 250,000 dirhams and not exceeding 1 million dirham, which is 5 times the penalty provided earlier. Now, when I talk about action through customs, Federal Decree Law Number 36, which regulates the trademarks of 2021, specifically provides for Article 45, whereby the custom is empowered to act and not to release the infringing the goods for 20 days. All the 7 emirates provide for registration of IP, which is trademark, copyright, and patent, with their respective customs authorities. It provides for inspection of goods, and IP rights holders can utilize those 20 days to ascertain whether or not the goods so within the possession of customs are in fact counterfeit or not. Then it also provides for remedies in terms of fines and penalties, along with seizures and destruction or recycling of counterfeit goods. In the year 2020, UAE Customs resolved 255 disputes, and the counterfeit goods seized or recycled were 923,724. In first quarter of 21, the UAE Customs resolved 81 disputes, and the number of counterfeit goods seized or recycled were 510,000. Now, when I talk about the administrative action, one can go in, the IP rights holder can go in for a complaint with the Department of Economic Development, which is followed in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, in Sharjah, or file a complaint directly with the Ministry of Economy, again followed in Ajman, Umm Al Quwain, Ras Al Khaimah, and Fujairah. It also leads to conducting of raids, search, seizure, destruction, and recycling of the counterfeit goods, and imposition of necessary fines and penalties as provided for under the law. We can help you with the enforcement of such IP rights, and we can suggest you which action is most suitable, which would primarily depend upon the rights being violated and what is the gravity of such violation. Thank you so much for listening.
So we now have Ali Arezi join us and to go through the rather complicated court system. So over to you, Ali.
Thank you, Patrick. I would talk about the system here in UAE, how it's a federal system. UAE consists of 7 emirates: Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Sharjah, Ajman, Umm Al Quwain, Ras Al Khaimah, and Al Fujairah. And Abu Dhabi, the capital of United Arab Emirates. The constitution of UAE is guiding a light for the legal system of the United Arab Emirates. Each emirate can either establish its own legal system or merge with a federal court system under the under constitution. Four legal systems, okay, means in UAE there are 4 supreme courts and also 4 general attorneys, means 4 public prosecution systems. And also there are 4 licensed has any lawyer to represent the clients in each court. Abu Dhabi, as the capital of UAE, and Sharjah, Adman, Fujairah, and Umm Al Quwain, they joined with the UAE federal legal system. And other emirate, Abu Dhabi, Ras Al Khaimah, and also Abu Dhabi, as an emirate of UAE, they have also the separate local legal system. 4 legal system is giving options to people to choose their jurisdiction. We'll talk about it later, but now I'm talking about the system is a standard system for all of countries, but in UAE courts auto system, this in divided into courts of first instance, courts of appeal, and Supreme Court. The Federal Supreme Court is located in Abu Dhabi, and also there are one more Supreme Court in Dubai and Ras Al Khaimah. But in Abu Dhabi, there also their Supreme Court is for a local system. Four system means options for parties to choose their courts. Lawyer has decided for their client where is the best court to file his case. There sometimes there are more than one parties or defended, and lawyer he can study where the best place to file case for their client. Because this depends up to the fees, this is because for legal systems they have their own local law, like Ras Al Khaimah, there are no cap to file fees with us Dubai. This is 6%, but their cap at 40,000 in Dubai, but in Ras Al Khaimah is the no cap. We'll talk now about criminal proceeding. The first step in the criminal proceeding is file complaint before the police or public prosecution. The criminal court consists of three stages: the court of first instance, the court of appeal, the Supreme Court. And here in a criminal proceeding also, the law penal code or criminal proceeding law, they are saving or giving all of parties their right to focusing to give a guarantee for accused to save his right to reply and giving him full chances to reply any complaint against him. For example, if the judgment issued in the absence, the accused may appeal by way of objection against judgment. And also for a victim, also he can ask for temporary compensation in a criminal court. To be party and attend. Courts of appeal, both of accused and public prosecution can appeal the judgment issued by the court of first instance, and accused and public prosecution has 15 days from the date of the judgment to file the appeal, and especially for general attorney has 30 days to appeal judgment. Court of Cassation. The cassation can be filed within 30 days from the date of issuing the judgment by the appeal court on points of law. Recent legal changes to faster justice and easing access to the legal system. Their competition between for legal systems to give good services to all people here in UAE. For example, in Dubai, they easier or yani they're yani giving services to be easier to access and using e-services and they have SPS, that Dubai Smart Police Station. It's the world first only unmanned smart police station. And this is like a building, it's without any team. You can enter and file your complaint, having coffee and dealing with the screen, and you can talk to police station through the screen and say what your complaint, And in same time, you will receive your reference number to continue your complaint. And also, Ministry of Interior, also they have application also to submit your complaint through your mobile and application, and also their website. Also, it is easy to for any victim to file his case anytime, 24 hours. I completed what I was discussing about, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Ali. And now we actually go to the second of our three cities, which is Abu Dhabi, where Nidal Al-Sayed will share with you an overview of Islamic banking, drawing on 2 decades of experience, including head of legal Islamic banking at National Bank of Abu Dhabi. Our final presenter for Abu Dhabi is Craig Coffill, who will talk about dispute resolution in Abu Dhabi and conclude with a fascinating and new arbitration case that stress tests the offshore-onshore enforcement in Abu Dhabi and in the UAE that our previous speakers have actually been highlighting. Thank you very much. So over to Nidal.
Thank you, Patrick. Hi, everybody. It's not an overstatement to say that the origins of Islamic banking are in the UAE. 48 years ago, the first regulated Islamic bank was established in the United Arab Emirates. And ever since, the successful journey continued. Islamic banking and finance is defined in the United Arab Emirates as banking, insurance, and asset management that comply with the principles of Islamic commercial transactions. There are 2 pillars. Of course, in addition to other elements, first pillar is prohibition of usury. Second pillar is avoidance of uncertainty. So Islamic banking is just a parallel system of banking in addition to the traditional banking. It's worth mentioning that the UAE cabinet has recently approved the service export development agenda, and amongst the agenda is financial and Islamic services, and this reveals the growth in this sector. Currently there are 6 Islamic banks, 9 finance companies, 12 insurance companies, and 15 windows, Islamic windows hosted by non-Islamic banks. The growth rate, the forecast globally, is between 10 to 11%, while in the UAE it's around 6.5% year on year. Islamic banks' assets amounts to 631.7 billion UAE dirhams by end of February of this year. The success, one of the success factors is the ability of the Islamic banking in the United Arab Emirates to diversify the portfolio of Islamic products, which enabled it to provide services to corporate clients, commercial clients, retail, asset management, and beyond. One important factor is that it's not uncommon to provide for English law as the governing law and for English courts as the competent courts. As my colleague will just let you know shortly, Mr. Craig, there are offshore jurisdictions in the UAE which would apply English law. So this is particularly important for syndications and cross-border transactions. Islamic banking and finance is very much and very well regulated in the United Arab Emirates. Now, I'll just focus on a bit of this regulation, part of these regulations, which is the higher Sharia authority. And the higher Sharia authority is the superior authority that is looking after the Islamic banking operations by setting the rules, defining the products, defining the parameters, and supervising the internal supervisory committees in each Islamic bank. And the significance of this is that it creates a unified platform for carrying on Sharia compliant or commercial transactions that are compliant with Islamic Sharia, Islamic jurisprudence. So it's quite important development, and it has been awaited for a long time. It has started its operations in 2018, though it has been provided for much earlier, since 1985. But lastly, it's in operation and it's conducting a quite important role in the development of Islamic finance industry in the UAE. So one important point of the higher Sharia authority is the consultations between the central bank and the authority, the Sharia authority, in case of violations from an Islamic financial institution. So based on these consultations, the central bank would take required action based on the advices it receives from the authority, and hence even not only the approach of conducting the Islamic compliant business, banking business, but also the penalties are quite known in advance. I would say that this is a quite important aspect of the regulatory framework in the UAE. It's quite robust. We have as well the consumer protection standards, the consumer protection regulations, CPR, CPS. So it's quite robust regulatory framework. As I have mentioned, the success of this industry in the UAE led to the UAE cabinet recent decision of approving the service export development agenda, which included financial and Islamic services to diversify the UAE exports, and this is considered as non-oil export. So the Islamic finance industry is quite successful in the UAE. The portfolio is diversified, it's well regulated, it has high growth rate, and it's being exported now. So that's all, Patrick, and I would be happy to receive any questions that you might have, whether now or later on through the link.
Okay, so we'll put the questions as they come into the chat box, and let's move on to Craig. Craig, if you can join us.
Good morning, everybody. On the right of the slide, you can see the island of Al Mara, which is in blue, and then the Al Reem Island. Now that's where the ADGM is jurisdiction is found. Initially, it started with the Al Mara Island, and recently it's moved to cover the jurisdiction of Al Reem Island. It is now one of the largest financial jurisdictions in the world. it's the ADGM's branches are divided into three broad topics: its registration authority, the financial regulations authority, and then the ADGM court system, which is what I'll be talking about. But just to say one thing on the registration authority and the financial services authority. We have seen a significant movement in corporate structuring, licensing requirements, and particularly IPO listings, and all of the requirements surrounding that. There seems to be significant potential in that aspect. Now, the ADGM itself is a common law developed legal system. It has a court, it has a division of three courts. It's commercial, it's employment, and it's small claims divisions, which is something we would all expect from a first court first instance. And then it has a court of appeal. Now, the one thing I want to emphasize in this court structure is if you go onto the ADGM website and you have a look at the types of judges you will be expected to appear in front of or expect to deal with your case, you will see that all of them are substantially experienced in their relative fields. Now, of importance is the ADGM Arbitration Center, which in my view sets it aside from most other arbitration institutions. Firstly, it's not an arbitration institution. So, for example, if the arbitration in Singapore wants to have a hearing through the ADGM, it is more than welcome to do that. The ADGM's arbitration regulations are based on the United Nations regulations, which is really unified throughout the world. Of recent importance is the connection the ICC, I beg your pardon, GM now has with the ICC. The ICC has chosen to open its first branch in the Middle East through the ADGM, and this again, in my view, puts the ADGM above many other choices of arbitration institutions because the ICC is well known. It comes with an important reputation, which is now linked to the ADGM. the ADGM, as well as the UAE, recognize the New York Convention. So when trying to enforce your arbitral awards, you can rely on the protections provided through the New York Convention. I must also add that both the ADGM and the UAE have various other multilateral agreements and MOUs with other jurisdictions to assist in enforcing international arbitration awards. Again, what sets the ADGM aside from other arbitration institutions is it has a case management office which permits you to run your arbitration through the ADGM on the rules you want to apply, which is important if that is how the parties want to go. Now, the ADGM, its physical building is breathtaking. It's a state of the art institution with all of the facilities to support either a physical hearing, a virtual hearing, or hybrid hearings, if that is what you elect to do. Now, to end off this presentation, I want to ask the question: Do the UAE courts and the ADGM enforce arbitral awards? Now, recently the ADGM was the chosen venue for a significant case in this region, which arbitration lawyers are very excited about. In this case, A6 v. B6, the claimant and defendant agreed to host an arbitration at the ADGM. They agreed that the ICC rules would apply and the governing law would be the UAE laws. Now, the claimant at the end of the case was unhappy with the award. It, rather than carry on through the arbitration process of the ICC, it elected to run off to the court of first instance in the UAE. The UAE court refused to hear the matter based on the arbitration agreement. Unhappy with that result, the claimant then went to the highest court in the UAE And again, the matter was refused to be entertained because of the arbitration agreement that was in place. Ultimately, the matter went back to the ADGM. Now, there are two important points that I need to make in this regard. Firstly, is the interplay there between a common law jurisdiction and the UAE tells us that one can expect confidence from this system. Both the UAE and the ADGM respect each other's jurisdictions, and once you choose one jurisdiction, you're not going to be able to go to the other because you don't like the results you were given. And secondly, and I suppose as importantly, is the issue of consistency. These types of decisions are expected to be consistently applied in both the UAE and common law jurisdictions such as the ADGM. And to end off, I'll say this, that consistency and confidence is one of the biggest litmus tests one would expect to be seen in international trade. And we have it here, and we welcome all of you with your business to our shores and hope to see you soon. Thank you, Patrick.
Great. Okay. So you've listened to the 30,000 feet map of the legal terrain of the UAE. We now travel 4,000 miles to Hong Kong SAR. In many ways, Hong Kong has served as a template for newer corporate hubs, such as Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And Julia Charlton will share with us how Hong Kong continues to evolve to provide the Middle East and Asia with an effective gateway into China. So over to Charlton's in Hong Kong, and to, I guess you've got a PowerPoint, so over to the PowerPoint there as well.
Sure. So my PowerPoint will come up in a minute. So thank you, Patrick. So having heard about the legal systems of Dubai and Abu Dhabi and the numerous exciting opportunities in these cities, I'm now going to virtually travel to the other side of Asia to talk about Hong Kong's legal and regulatory framework, arbitration, and Hong Kong's role as a bridge between China and the Middle East. Well, as many of you already know, Hong Kong is an autonomous special administrative region that operates under the one country, two systems principle. Hong Kong's status as an international financial center is included in Hong Kong's mini constitution, the Hong Kong Basic Law. And under the Basic Law, the city's political system is divided into three parts. Its executive is headed by the Chief Executive of Hong Kong, who's supported by the Executive Council on Policymaking, the legislature comprised of the Legislative Council and the District Councils, and there is also the judiciary. Hong Kong's judiciary, quote, is responsible for the administration of justice in Hong Kong, hears all prosecutions and civil disputes, and is completely independent of the executive authorities and legislature, unquote. Hong Kong's legal profession is divided into barristers and solicitors in the same way as in England and Wales. And Hong Kong, as many of you will know, has a common law legal system which is based on English law. Proceedings in the Hong Kong courts may be conducted in either Chinese or English, as both are official languages of Hong Kong, although Chinese is becoming increasingly prevalent. Hong Kong's highest appellate court is the Court of Final Appeal. There is the High Court, comprised of the Court of Appeal and the Court of First Instance. All three courts hear appeals on both civil and criminal matters. Below the appellate courts are the District Court, which hears civil disputes where the value of the dispute is between 75,000 and 3 million Hong Kong dollars, and hears criminal cases with a sentence of up to 7 years imprisonment. There's also the Family Court, the Competition Tribunal, which deals with legal proceedings concerning competition matters, and the Market Misconduct Tribunal, which is an independent body established under the Securities and Futures Ordinance, where proceedings are chaired by three individuals, two members of the Market Misconduct Tribunal and a judge or former judge of the High Court. And the Market Misconduct Tribunal deals with misconduct under the Securities and Futures Ordinance, including insider dealing, false trading, price rigging, stock market manipulation, disclosure of information, and disclosure of false or misleading information inducing transactions in securities and futures contracts. Appeals brought in the District Court, Lands Tribunal, Competition Tribunal, and Market Misconduct Tribunal all go directly to the Court of Appeal. At the base of the structure are the seven magistrates' courts, which hear criminal proceedings, and there's also the small claims tribunal for civil claims of up to HK$75,000. Other courts in Hong Kong are the Lands and Labour Tribunal, the Obscene Articles Tribunal, the Coroner's Courts, and the Juvenile Court. Besides formal litigation, alternative dispute resolution, ADR, is available in Hong Kong. The most common forms of ADR in Hong Kong are arbitration and mediation, and I'll talk about arbitration a bit later. On the subject of mediation in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong Department of Justice launched a campaign to promote mediation as a form of dispute resolution around 15 years ago. This is the Mediate First Pledge campaign. And the mediation ordinance governing the conduct of mediations in Hong Kong came into effect in 2013. So although mediation is not a precondition to litigation in Hong Kong, parties who unreasonably refuse to participate in mediation may be subject to adverse court orders, in particular in relation to costs. Mediation may take place under the process set out in the mediation ordinance and the mediation code, or a set of procedures agreed upon by the parties led by the appointed mediator. The limitation periods for mediation are the same as for court actions, which are 6 years for actions founded on contract or tort, and 12 years for actions founded on a contract created by deed. Commercial parties in Hong Kong are becoming increasingly aware of mediation as a means to resolve disputes. And in 2020, 61% and 53% of cases filed in the Court of First Instance and the District Court, respectively, were either settled by mediation or concluded within 6 months afterwards. So, turning now to doing business in Hong Kong. In the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business ranking for 2020, Hong Kong ranked third globally at that time. Additionally, in the 2022 World Justice Report's Rule of Law Index 2022, Hong Kong ranked 18th globally in terms of regulatory enforcement. Hong Kong itself is also uniquely placed in terms of its proximity to China, facilitating access to the mainland China market. Combined with a low, simple, and competitive tax system and a world-class infrastructure and its US dollar-linked currency, it's an attractive city for conducting business. As of this year, there were just under 1.4 million local companies, including public and private companies, registered with the Hong Kong Companies Registry, and over 14,000 registered non-Hong Kong companies. In terms of setting up a business in Hong Kong, a foreign corporation can carry on business in Hong Kong by setting up a company incorporated in Hong Kong, or by setting up a branch office. Or they can also try setting up some less common business vehicles, such as a sole proprietorship or a partnership or limited partnership. Company incorporation in Hong Kong is relatively easy, as there's no law or regulation requiring a local resident to act as the director or shareholder of a company, although having a director with a Hong Kong permanent identity card can be helpful for bank account opening purposes. Like many other financial centres, the requirements for bank account opening have become increasingly onerous in Hong Kong in recent years. Companies in Hong Kong may be public or private. They can be limited by shares or by guarantee, and they're all incorporated under the company's ordinance by the company's registry. Companies limited by guarantee are usually incorporated for the purpose of forming an NGO or a charitable organisation, which has certain tax advantages under Section 88 of the Inland Revenue Ordinance. The majority of companies listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, however, are not incorporated in Hong Kong. As of 2023, 70% of companies listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange were incorporated in Cayman or Bermuda. They are also subject to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange listing rules and Securities and Futures Commission regulations, the Takeover Code and Code on Share Buybacks. And most non-listed Hong Kong companies are private companies limited by shares, which restrict the right to transfer shares, prohibit public invitations to subscribe for shares, and limit the number of shareholders to 50 under their articles of association. All companies in Hong Kong on incorporation have to have at least one shareholder of any nationality, a company secretary who has to be in Hong Kong, and a director who is a natural person and who can be any nationality. Companies also have to obtain a business registration certificate issued by the Inland Revenue Department, which is done simultaneously with the company registry incorporation. In terms of ongoing monitoring, companies are required to file an annual return with the company's registry detailing the company's share capital, shareholders, directors, and registered charges. All this information is available to the public, and all companies also have to prepare audit reports for the relevant financial year. Public companies also have to file these accounts at the company's registry. Where a person, usually a natural person, holds more than 25% of the shares or voting rights of a company, or has the right to exercise significant influence or control of the company has to maintain a register of significant controllers, which is available for inspection, but it's not a public register. This register of significant controllers can be inspected by regulatory authorities, including, for example, the company's registry, the SFC, the insurance authority, the police, etc. Foreign company may also create a branch by registering as a registered non-Hong Kong company under Part 16 of the company's ordinance. This involves the submission of certified copies of its application form, memorandum and articles of association, latest published accounts of the foreign company. And similar to private companies in Hong Kong, they'll be required to obtain a business registration certificate, file an annual return annually, and if required to do so by their country of incorporation, file a copy of their annual accounts on public record with the company's registry. It takes around a week usually to incorporate a company. It can be quicker, but obviously collecting all the documents can take longer than that. There are also processes for setting up investment funds, which I'm not going to go into today. In March 2023, the Financial Services and Treasury Bureau, which is part of the Hong Kong government, proposed an amendment to the company's ordinance to introduce an inward redomicile scheme similar to schemes like this in other common law jurisdictions such as Canada, New Zealand and Singapore. And this new regime would allow a company domiciled elsewhere to change its place of incorporation to Hong Kong while maintaining its legal identity as a body corporate. So it's like the company changes its passport and moves to be incorporated in Hong Kong. So a re-domiciled company can take the form of any type of company available to be incorporated under the company's ordinance. And once re-domiciled, the company will have the same rights and obligations as other locally incorporated companies, will be required to comply with the relevant company's ordinance requirements. The FSTB doesn't intend to impose an economic substance test on the applicant companies, and the Inland Revenue Ordinance may be amended to address certain transitional tax matters, which may be an issue. Regarding the proposed application process, the Registrar of Companies will approve the application after considering factors such as whether the type of Hong Kong company the applicant company chooses to re-domicile as is the same or substantially the same. For example, is it one company limited by guarantee in another jurisdiction re-registering as a company limited by guarantee in Hong Kong? The integrity of the applicant company, whether the application is made in good faith and or with the agreement of its shareholders, and whether the company is solvent. Now, this all remains currently at the proposal stage, and the FSTB has, in fact, commenced a consultation process. I would mention that the proposed framework doesn't include a mechanism for the outward migration of Hong Kong companies to other jurisdictions. So turning now to listing on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, a very major part of Hong Kong's scene. Capital markets are very important here. As at the end of March 2023, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange ranked seventh globally and fourth in Asia with a market cap of $4,700 billion at the end of last year. Between January and the end of May of this year, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange had 28 new listings on its main board, and their combined market cap totaled over 15.5 billion Hong Kong dollars. All of the companies were incorporated overseas. The listings also included one biotech company. The Stock Exchange in Hong Kong is operated by the Stock Exchange of Hong Kong, which is a subsidiary of Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing, HKEX. And unlike some other jurisdictions which have competing stock exchanges in the same place, for example, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ in the US, Hong Kong only has one exchange. And there's no other entity in Hong Kong is allowed to provide stock exchange services in Hong Kong. Stock Exchange is the only recognized exchange company under the Securities and Futures Ordinance and is itself the principal regulator of the exchange participants in relation to trading matters and companies listed on the Hong Kong Exchange's main board and GEM. The HKEX itself is a listed company. This means that the HKEX is listing and trading on itself, and to avoid actual or potential conflict of interest, the HKEX's own listing is regulated by the SFC. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange consists of a main board for larger companies with a market cap of at least over 500 million Hong Kong dollars, but there's various other criteria which may be met for listing at the time of listing. Most of them are financial eligibility tests. There's also a GEM board for smaller companies, but that's only had one IPO in the past 2 years or so. Over the past few years, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange has also introduced specialized listing requirements or specific categories for listed companies, and these include pre-revenue mineral companies, pre-revenue, pre-profit biotech companies, companies with weighted voting rights structures, overseas secondary issuers seeking secondary listing in Hong Kong, and SPACs, special purpose vehicle companies. Most recently, the Hong Kong Exchange has introduced the listing of pre-revenue specialist technology companies. Hong Kong, I should mention, also has an active listed debt market, and as a whole, Hong Kong's gross issuance of debt is just over 1,200 billion Hong Kong dollars, and this includes private and public sector debt issuance. In relation to the listing process itself, if you want to list the company, this can take about 6 months to complete, but for the majority of companies, the reality is that listing would take at least a year. The Hong Kong Exchange's own rules allow the application process to be completed in around 2 months. However, in practice, this timing is unlikely for most companies, especially for smaller companies applying to list. For smaller companies, it can take up to around 2 years. So in terms of processing time in Hong Kong, it's actually faster often for larger companies to list than for small companies. So listing in Hong Kong, as in many places, involves a number of stages. Sometimes there's an initial submission and company reorganization, which may be necessary to be carried out. In all cases, an investment bank has to be appointed as a sponsor, and due diligence and verification and the drafting of the prospectus and other documents needs to be carried out. This is followed by a listing application and then vetting by the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and the SFC, following which, if it's successful, there's a listing committee hearing and approval of listing. And the registration of the prospectus with the Registrar of Companies. So the prospectus, after it's published and the offering is completed, would mean that trading in the newly listed company shares could commence. The SFC has recently introduced regulatory requirements for SFC licensed intermediaries and investment banks in relation to book building and placings in connection with Hong Kong IPOs. The Hong Kong Exchange also has a separate futures and options market. And in addition, there is a mutual market access program called Stock Connect, which you may have heard of. It's northbound and southbound. Northbound is investors from Hong Kong investing in stock listed in China, and southbound is investors in China investing in Hong Kong listed shares. And this allows, obviously, investors in mainland China and in Hong Kong to trade and settle shares listed in the other jurisdiction using the other countries' respective stock exchange and clearing markets. And this is currently limited to shares and ETFs. On the crypto front, crypto ETFs have been listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange in December last year, and they raised $79 million in initial investment. These ETFs also allow investors to access crypto futures traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. In terms of the types of companies listed on the Hong Kong Exchange, the majority of companies listed are not incorporated in Hong Kong, but are in fact incorporated in either Cayman or Bermuda. However, the business of these companies is most often in China. And as of April this year, over 60% of the companies in the Hang Seng Index comprise Chinese-based businesses, whether their holding companies are incorporated in or outside mainland China. So turning now to arbitration in Hong Kong. Well, according to the 2021 International Arbitration Survey, over 90% of respondents saw international arbitration as a means of resolving cross-border disputes and find it increasingly important. And the top five preferred seats for arbitration were London, Singapore, Hong Kong, Paris, and Geneva. The Hong Kong International Arbitration Center is also in the top five most preferred arbitral institutions behind the Singapore International Arbitration Center and ahead of the London Court of International Arbitration and the China International Economic Trade Arbitration Commission, CETAC. So arbitration in Hong Kong is primarily governed by the arbitration ordinance, which came into effect in 2011. And the ordinance applies to all arbitrations in Hong Kong and governs the procedures and process for arbitrations. It adopted the model code provisions of the UNCTRAL Model Law on International Commercial Arbitration, including the 2006 amendments within the main body of its text. And the HKIAC, the Hong Kong Office of the International Chamber of Commerce, and the Hong Kong Arbitration Centre of CTAC are the three most commonly used arbitral institutions in Hong Kong for large commercial disputes when it comes to the appointment of arbitrators. So in terms of how arbitration works in Hong Kong, it's usually up to the parties to the dispute to agree on how to resolve the dispute. There are also several mandatory provisions of the arbitration ordinance. The arbitration agreements must be in writing, the court can order a stay of court proceedings in favor of arbitration, and the High Court has the power to grant interim measures of protection. Arbitrators have to disclose circumstances that cast doubt on their independence and impartiality. They can be challenged in relation to justifiable doubts as to their impartiality or independence, and that the arbitral tribunal can rule on its own jurisdiction. The parties have to be treated equally, the form and content requirements of an arbitral award are covered, and the court has the power to set aside an arbitral award. The number of arbitrators is determined by the parties. However, if the parties fail to agree on the matter, the HKICA may decide between one arbitrator or three arbitrators. In terms of their qualification, there is no requirement that an arbitrator has to be licensed. Again, the parties themselves may specify any professional requirements. Certain types of disputes are non-arbitral in Hong Kong. These include disputes relating to criminal and family law matters, action in rem against vessels, administrative law matters such as tax and immigration, and certain consumer disputes and specific performance of any contract relating to land. However, since 2018, disputes relating to intellectual property rights, including contractual disputes on the transfer and licensing of IP rights and IP infringement claims, can be resolved by arbitration in Hong Kong, and the resulting arbitral awards are enforceable. With regard to enforcement, the Hong Kong courts have the authority to issue an injunction in support of arbitral proceedings in both Hong Kong and a foreign country via a worldwide injunction. They can also appoint interim receivers to preserve assets and the status quo in support of an arbitral proceeding. Hong Kong is also the only seat of arbitration outside mainland China that allows parties to seek interim relief from the PRC courts via an interim relief arrangement with qualified arbitral institutions locally. This arrangement came into force in 2019. The arbitration ordinance provides for four separate regimes on arbitration awards: Hong Kong awards and non-New York Convention awards, New York Convention awards, PRC awards via the supplemental arrangement concerning mutual enforcement of arbitral awards, and fourthly, Macau awards. However, under each regime, the successful party in the arbitration must seek the leave of the court in order to be granted the award. Finally, under the Contracts Rights of Third Parties Ordinance, where a third party seeks the right to enforce a term of a contract subject to an arbitration agreement, they are treated as a party to the arbitration agreement for the purposes of enforcement of that term. Turning now to the Greater Bay Area. Well, Hong Kong has long been regarded as and has acted as a gateway to China, and I could go into a lot of history, but I'll just mention that in the 1990s, after Deng Xiaoping's historic visit to Shenzhen in 1992, both the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and the Hong Kong Capital Markets played a pivotal role in listing 8 shares of Chinese companies on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange starting in 1993. And this, in turn, paved the way for the enormous investment in China's economy and the growth of its own capital markets. And today, Hong Kong remains a top-ranking international financial center and is the world's largest renminbi business hub, with nearly 800 billion in RMB deposits as of the end of March 2023. So what is the Greater Bay Area? Well, the Greater Bay Area includes the two special administrative regions of Hong Kong and Macau, and 9 municipalities within China, including Guangzhou and Shenzhen. The GDP of the Guangdong, Hong Kong, Macau, Greater Bay Area reached nearly $2,000 billion US dollars, with over half of the GDP being in tertiary industries. The population of the Greater Bay Area as of last year was 86.6 million. And as some have pointed out, this was around the same size as the population of Germany. The Global Innovation Index 2022 highlighted that China has the same number of global top science and technology clusters as the US. Science and technology clusters refer to formal umbrella structures for science and technology organizations in various cities to have better synergy while retaining their autonomy. In particular, the Shenzhen, Hong Kong, Guangzhou, China and Hong Kong, China cluster ranked second after the Tokyo, Yokohama, Japanese cluster and ahead of the Beijing, Seoul and San Jose, San Francisco clusters. So what is Hong Kong's role in the GBA, the Greater Bay Area? Well, according to the original framework agreement signed in 2017, Hong Kong's role was to consolidate and enhance its status as an international financial transportation and trade center, strengthen its status as a global offshore renminbi business hub and an international asset management center, promote the development of its professional services and innovation and technology industries, and establish a center for international legal and dispute resolution services in the Asia Pacific region. The 2019 Greater Bay Area Outline Development Plan further named Hong Kong as one of the four core cities of the GBA, reiterating its role as a global RMB business hub and an international asset management and risk management center. The plan also emphasized the development of high-end industries and strengthening innovation and technology in Hong Kong. Additionally, the plan also identified a number of initiatives, including, for example, supporting Hong Kong private equity funds to participate in Greater Bay Area projects, and also, for example, supporting insurance institutions in Guangdong, Hong Kong, and Macau to jointly develop innovative cross-boundary insurance products. Since 2019, several financial services-related initiatives have been launched. The Cross-Boundary Wealth Management Connect was launched in September 2021 and allowed eligible residents in Hong Kong, Macau, and nine other cities in Guangdong Province to carry out cross-boundary investment in specified wealth management products distributed by banks within the area. In relation to Hong Kong's role in the Greater Bay Area, there are a number of business advantages for Hong Kong, including provisions for seeking interim relief from the PRC courts in relation to arbitration. And also, Hong Kong is the only common law jurisdiction in China, which may be much more friendly more familiar for international companies to use, which means that Hong Kong's role in the Greater Bay Area may make it a launch pad for overseas companies to come to Hong Kong and access the Greater Bay Area. Finally, there are also pilot measures for Hong Kong legal practitioners to obtain mainland practice qualifications, and the first GBA professional exam was held in June 2022, and this allows Hong Kong lawyers to access the mainland market for their legal services. So that's a very quick overview of the Greater Bay Area and some other aspects of wonderful Hong Kong. So Patrick, back to you.
Right. Well, we've very much enjoyed giving you the view of three cities. I think that wraps it up. I mean, both, all three cities are fantastic. We've enjoyed the Al Sawidi presentation and the Charlton presentation. If you do have any questions, do please contact us with the various emails and also visit our website for any further information that you may have. Julia, any closing remarks you'd like to share?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm really like to say again that I'm truly honored to be in part of this webinar with Mr. Mohammed Al-Sawidi and his colleagues. And thank you very much also, Patrick. So thank you very much again for joining us today. I do hope that perhaps we can do one of these webinars again and that we will see you all again in the future. Thank you.
Great. And actually, we do have a question it relates. I'll just read it, actually. So it's actually to do with Craig's slides. So Craig, get yourself ready. In Mr. Coffield's slides, it is noted that the ADGM courts handle employment matters. Hong Kong requires all cases to be handled by the employment tribunal as a general rule, and lawyers have no right of audience at that level to keep costs to a minimum. On the other hand, it would appear that the ADGM courts require all employment matters to be heard before a judge and lawyers. This can be quite disadvantageous to employees. So that's a statement rather than a question, but would anyone like to pick up either employment in Hong Kong or employment in the UAE? And any comments to that question? I think I know where it comes from.
We have a similar system actually in the UAE where all employment dispute, before it reaches the court, it should be filed with the Ministry of Labor. And they file the case over there, and if they don't, it doesn't get settled, then the case will be transferred to court. And it's a prerequisite to be filed with the Ministry of Labor before. Otherwise, the case might be dismissed. It will be dismissed if you file a case within the court directly, whether from the employee or the employer, also, even if it goes to court, usually, I mean, the court will be very, mostly they are pro-employee rather than pro-employer, and they will provide the translators, you know, for the employee. But that's on the, say, the civil court system, not in the ADGM. ADGM, you know, is just developing this labor dispute, and I think that might be a step later on to have a conciliation committee before it goes to court.
Okay, so you know, my very limited knowledge, and I'm not a lawyer, so none of this constitutes any kind of advice or anything like that. But my impression is that the courts tend to perhaps favour employers rather than employees. I don't know if that's a fair comment regarding UAE.
UAE, it is a pro-employee. It's pro-employee.
Oh, pro-employee. Okay.
Yeah. And the whole labour law is actually pro-employee. You know, being the weaker part. In fact, we have the only unique system in the world. Again, there is a payment system for all the salary to be paid on time. You know, it has to go through the government system, which shows that you paid your employees. I think that we are the only country in the world that had the system. You know, I really want to add something to Julia. I mean, not add. I mean, just maybe a suggestion. As a lot of companies that are listed in Hong Kong are actually, registered in Bermuda and other countries. Maybe we should have them registered in Dubai or Abu Dhabi, you know?
Yeah, let's have a good look at that. That's a great idea.
We should do that together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think we'll wrap up now. I don't think Emmanuel has been able to join us, sadly. But a great seminar nonetheless. And thank you all very much indeed for joining. And goodbye from Julia in Hong Kong. And Mohammed in... Where are you, Mohammed?
I am in Belgrade, actually.
Okay.
So, but my internet is not really strong enough. I apologize. That is what I have in the hotel.
Great. Okay. Thank
I have
you
to bring my UAE clothes in order to attend to look at really representing the UAE here. You know, but I'm going to take it off as soon as I'm leaving the room now.
Okay. Well, we hope to be able to do events like this in person as well. This has been quite an efficient way to bridge quite a few different regions. But thank you all very much indeed. And thank you all.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.